Welcome back. Coast's webmaster tonight, Sean Latasur, has posted a remarkable story on the featured section. It's an image captured by NASA's Curiosity rover on August the 14th, and it's causing quite a stir online, with internet users and bloggers asserting that an alien thigh bone has been spotted on the red planet. "Normally I see rocks as rocks," said one commentator. "This can't be a thigh bone, can it?" Others have suggested this find is merely a product of the brain's tendency to spot patterns in otherwise random data. Well, there's an image there, and it certainly looks like a bone. My question is, well, we don't even know what Martians looked like. If there were Martians, how do we know that Martians weren't 20 feet tall? Maybe that's not a thigh bone. How do we know it's not a Martian clavicle or a scapula or a mandible or a sternum or a xiphoid process? Anyway, check out the image. It's quite remarkable. It could be a thigh bone. It could be. Jim Mars is about to climb aboard here and do what Jim does best, tie things together, make sense of the world. Jim sees the world through the lens of someone whose research, taught, written extensively about the role of extraterrestrials in human evolution, or devolution, if you will. In his essay, Unholy Alliance, Ancient Astronauts and the New World Financial Order, he writes, "Throughout history, the two most prominent methods of controlling the human population have been religion and finance. Could these well-honed, time-tested mechanisms be of extraterrestrial origin?" Jim Mars will connect the dots when Coast to Coast AM continues. Jim Mars really needs no introduction to Coast listeners, but if you're new to the program, here's the Reader's Digest version of Mr. Mars' CV. Jim is a native of Fort Worth, Texas, an award-winning journalist and a four-time New York Times best-selling author. In 1997, his in-depth investigation of UFOs, Alien Agenda, was published and eventually translated into several foreign languages, becoming the top-selling nonfiction UFO book in the world. His latest book, Our Occulted History, Do the Global Elite Conceal Ancient Aliens? And now he's revisited that theme in a short essay entitled Unholy Alliance, Ancient Astronauts and the New World Financial Order, which is part of an anthology called Lost Secrets of the Gods, published by New Page Books. Howdy, Jim. How are you?
Howdy, Richard. It's good to talk with you again. Maybe a month or two?
It has.
We were together in Toronto.
We did. We tucked into a nice steak and we swapped a few tales.
Right.
Your essay is included in this anthology, which also includes essays by Nick Redfern, Micah Hanks, Paul Von Ward. Yours is the final essay in the book, which I think is appropriate because you really tie everything together. Because what you're arguing, as best as I can understand, Jim, is that virtually all human institutions, all knowledge, all political machinations, all governance, all human history, really, all wars, even political assassinations like JFK, must be understood, can only be understood within the context of an intervention here on Earth by ancient astronauts, a race of ETs. So is this the final word on human history as far as you're concerned?
Well, I'm not saying that, okay? I'm simply accumulating and translating and putting down for my readers what our ancient ancestors have told us. Richard, it's absolutely amazing. And, of course, I don't think I'm really telling you, and probably not most of the Coast listeners, anything new when I tell you that if you go back through history all the way back, I mean go back prior to our written history, and you consider the most ancient cultures in the world, the Dogon tribe in Africa, the Aborigines in Australia, the Hopi Indians, the Aztecs, the ancient Chinese. Whoa, they all tell the same story. Gods came from the sky and taught them things, taught them civilization, taught them numbers and mathematics, taught them law, taught them language, for God's sakes, taught them how to grow things, how to do things. I give you one example. As you well know, because since we shared a few beers up in Toronto, I'm just one of those that kind of likes my beer. Well, I often wondered, where did beer come from anyway? It's ubiquitous. Every country's got their beers, and as soon as you're past the age of maturity, you want to go out and try a beer. Where'd it come from? Wine, I can understand. because, you know, some caveman stumbling along, it's a hot, dry day, and he comes upon some grapes that have been lying there in the sun and got fermented, but he's going to eat them anyway, and then gets a little tipsy and says, hey, this is pretty cool. So he starts growing grapes, and he's got wine. But beer, you have to have hops and malts, and you have to mix them with just the right amount, and you have to put in sugar, and then you have to ferment them, and then you have to, you know, let them, it's a process.
It's complicated. You're right.
Complicated.
You're right.
I mean, I've tried that. I tried making my own beer, and it's a mess. And, hey, you know, so how did they learn that? Well, you go back to the earliest known writings of humans, and that is the cuneiform tablets of the Sumerians, which predate the Egyptians by thousands of years. They are the very first centered in ancient Mesopotamia, which is now, of course, Iraq, the one place on the world that we can't just freely go to. And they said that the Anunnaki came and taught them how to make beer. In fact, they had four different kinds of beer. I doubt one of those was light. But they had four different kinds, and they said, yes, these Anunnaki told them how to do that. And who are the Anunnaki? Well, that translates as those who came from the heavens and landed on the earth. Hello, there you go.
Sure. I mean, it's one thing to argue that some ET civilization had a hand, perhaps kick-started human civilization, taught us how to domesticate wild plants and animals and so forth, and give birth to modern agriculture. But another to maybe suggest that there is a connection between, or an unholy alliance, to quote from your essay, an unholy alliance between these ancient astronauts and let's say the world's religion. How are we to understand organized religion in light of this ET intervention?
Well, let's just put it this way. Let's say that we improve our NASA program, and we actually developed interstellar drive, and we're able to go to another solar system where there's an inhabitable planet, and we land there, and we find some very primitive human-type people there. We land, we come down a fiery blast, and we get out and say, hello, you know, we want to be your friends. We're from the Earth. And what are they going to do? They're going to fall down and start worshiping us because they think we must be gods. And in fact, that's what's really interesting is when you go back to the earliest writings of mankind and the earliest stories, it's only come down to us as gods because, for example, in the 1800s, up until the mid-1800s, no, we didn't even know about the Sumerians or the ancient Sumerian culture because it had been so long in the past, and most of the cities were in ruins, buried under the sands. And so, but they started digging them out, and they started reading and deciphering these cuneiform tablets, and they read about these people that were flying through the air, and they were reading about how that they were able to create and these life forms and change life forms, manipulate the programs like that, and they, you know, in mid-1800s, they didn't think man could fly, they didn't know about atoms, they didn't know any of this stuff, so they said, oh, well, this is their mythology, these were their gods, and that's come down to us as mythology. And in fact, we all are fairly familiar with the Greek mythology. You know, there's been a lot of movies recently about the Titans and Let Loose the Kraken, you know, and we're pretty familiar with that. These are all Greek tales about their gods that's come to us as the Titan gods. Well, Titan is the word that came from ancient Sumeria, the Sumerians, and it meant those who came from space. And so it's all the same thing. It's these ancient astronauts came here, and ancient men either started worshiping them as gods because they didn't know any better, or perhaps these ancient astronauts, instructed them to worship them as gods because, hey, what better control mechanism, you know? And then after a while, when they didn't want to get their hands dirty, directly dealing with the scrubby old humans, they got hybrids that they had worked on, according to the tablets, and they made them kings and priests. Well, now, you know, they come to you and say, okay, I'm the priest, and I represent God. And God told me to tell you, here's how you're supposed to live. And, you know, that's been carrying on right up to this very day. Now, let me quickly back up here, Richard. I don't want anybody to get the idea that I'm trying to say that there's no God and that God's an alien or anything like that. No, there is a metaphysical aspect to the universe, and there is a universal creative force, and there are spiritual matters. But that's not really what we're getting into. What we're into here is ancient Earth's history.
I'm glad sort of issued that caveat, because that was going to be my next question. Does this necessarily preclude, you know, the God of the Old Testament, Jesus Christ, the divinity of Christ, and so forth? But that's another matter. Okay, good. We've settled that.
Absolutely. In fact, let me put it this way. Years ago, working on my book, Alien Agenda, about UFOs, and I was talking, I had interviewed a lot of these people who say they've been abducted, okay? And this one woman was a very religious woman, and she's abducted, taken on these ships, and she's going, well, what about God? You know, or do you come from God? Do you believe in God? And one of them finally said, I guess almost exasperated, said, hey, our God is your God. And, you know, if you stop and think about it, if there is a God and he's the creating force of the universe, then he's the creating force of everybody, not just us.
True enough. Well, so just to follow along here then, you're saying that only after the Anunnaki appointed rulers over humanity did the concept of religion come into play.
Right. So, long after, actually, probably. They may have actually worked with them there for a time, but then, you know, it's an easy control mechanism. I'm from God. You think I'm from God? Okay, that's good. I am. Now, here's what you do. And they tell us what to do. Now, the problem began because there were not just one or two of these Anunnakis there. This is a whole group of people that came here and maybe even set up a colony. And they appointed various kings and priests. And just these whole religious and political systems grew up around them. And then they would get in fights with each other over territory and resources, sometimes just personal jealousies. And so they'd send their armies to fight with each other. And all you have to do is read the Old Testament. And it was just one battle after another.
There was a whole lot of smiting going on.
Between all these kings and between the gods and everything else. So, and this, I think, may explain the dichotomy that we find in the Old Testament between, in the Bible actually, between the God of vengeance and anger and revenge and the God of love and conciliation and et cetera that we're taught about in the New Testament, you know? And that's because we're talking about different personalities.
Is it your contention, or is it based on your research, your conclusion that this strife, pitting one kingdom against another, this was done at the behest of the Anunnaki as a method of controlling, divide and conquer?
Right. It's the same thing they're doing today. You know, we're being divided and conquered in this country today. After Pearl Harbor, when we actually had been attacked by a foreign enemy, and we actually were in danger from the German Nazis, President Roosevelt came on the nationwide radio and said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Let's bind together and let's roll up our sleeves and let's, you know, save the country, save democracy. And everybody jumped in. And now look what we're getting. Oh, it's a yellow-orange terrorist. Watch out, they're after you. Everybody's after us. And, oh, it's black versus white and man versus women and heterosexual versus homosexual and, you know, just everything they can think of to keep us divided up and fighting with each other. It's a time-honored method of control. And now then that religion has faded somewhat. I think the latest polls show that and on the average, America is just not quite as religious orientated as it was just 20, 30, 40 years ago. So now the main control mechanism is money, and the two are inseparable. If you think about it, Jesus, the Prince of Peace, you know, when was the one time that he really got mad and got violent and kicked some butt? That was when he went after the money changers. And where were they? Were they in their bank? No, they were in the temple, because money and religion have been the two primary control mechanisms that have been used to keep the human herd in under control.
Well, let's explore that thread a little bit. When did finance become so enmeshed in religion?
All the way back. All the way back. Again, you go back to the Bible and you find that most of the commerce was taking place in the temple. And then you get to the Middle Ages, and we all know about the kings and queens of the various dynasties there in Europe that fought with each other, schemed against each other, and yet they were all beholden to the Roman Church and the Pope. And it was the Roman Church that, if not propping them up by loans and by support, at least gave them religious excuse, you know, the divine right of kings for their position. And so the church and finance have been intertwined all the way back.
We'll revisit some of these themes. Jim Marrs is with us, award-winning journalist, New York Times best-selling author, and his new essay, Unholy Alliance, Ancient Astronauts and the New World Financial Order. And we'll open up the phones a little bit later in the program as well for Jim, take questions and comments. What happened, though, to organized religion, the priestly order, and also the royal family that were sort of put in place by, let's say, the Anunnaki, after these ET civilizations, for whatever reason, cut off human contact or withdrew from the planet, if in fact that's what happened?
Well, yeah, if in fact that's what happened, this is a thing that I attempted to ask Zachariah Sitchin on one occasion, and of course he's the one who penned what I think about like 10 or 12 books about. He's translated the Sumerian tablets and then interpreted them to mean that these Anunnaki essentially were ancient astronauts that came from another planet, and he picked up on the theme from Eric von Däniken, who wrote Chariots of the Gods years ago, and it's been that issue has been probed and expanded upon ever since. But I wanted to approach Mr. Sitchin and say, I thought it was a simple question. I said, look, if what you're saying is true and these ancient astronauts were here on the planet thousands of years ago, I said, what happened? Did they all leave, or are some of them, at least some of them, still here? I thought that was a legitimate question. He ducked me. He would see me coming and turn and run the other way. And then finally I got up and asked him in front of a crowd. I stood in line with everybody else and asked him that question. And he rambled on about 15 minutes. And later all these people said, hey, he never did answer your question. I said, yeah, I know. But I finally understand that, because
it's a good question. It's a question that has to be asked.
Exactly. But I understand now why I didn't answer it, especially in front of everybody. Because if you answer it correctly, the answer is some of them are still here. And how do I know that? Well, all you have to do is look at human history. If, as we're taught in school, it was just one slow evolutionary climb from cavemen to hunter-gatherers and then, you know, city states and then nations and then empires. Well, okay, that's what we'd have on the record. It wouldn't be anything else. But if you go back and look, you find that all throughout history, there's the Hindu Vedas talk of flying machines and weapons that can destroy a whole city. You got the Bible with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, that obviously was a planned event because they were warned it was going to happen. This wasn't just some accident or a meteor or something.
All right, Jim, we've got to jump in here. We're going to head into a break with Bob Dylan. And we'll come back. More of our conversation, Unholy Alliance, Ancient Astronauts, and the New World Financial Order with the one and only Jim Marrs here on Coast to Coast AM. More of my conversation with Jim Marrs, a legendary investigative journalist, JFK researcher, and the author of an essay, which is part of an anthology entitled Lost Secrets of the Gods, The Latest Evidence and Revelations on Ancient Astronauts, Precursor Cultures, and Secret Societies. And Jim's significant contribution to the anthology is entitled Unholy Alliance, Ancient Astronauts, and the New World Financial Order. Back with more of Jim and Coast to Coast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast. Jim Marrs is with us. Unholy Alliance. We're talking about the ancient astronauts and the New World Financial Order. You know, you mentioned a beer and how beer may have come about, sort of a gift to humankind from the Anunnaki. But the other interesting thing that I've never been able to figure out exactly is our fascination with gold. It's universal. We have imbued this yellow metal with such importance, and yet, I mean, it really has no intrinsic value. It's not like silver. It can be used in photovoltaics and other industrial purposes. Gold has no real value except what we give it. And I'm wondering if there's a connection between gold and the Anunnaki.
Well, apparently there is, Richard. Both Mr. Sitchin and other people such as Michael Tellinger, Arthur Harn, C.L. Turnage, there are several people who have read, interpreted, and translated the ancient Sumerian tablets, and they pretty much agree that these Anunnaki who came to the Earth, they weren't just exploring in space. They were looking for resources, and particularly they were looking for something to repair the atmosphere of their home planet. And that's pretty interesting because I can recall when Dr. Edward Teller, called the father of the H-bomb, suggested years ago, when it became obvious that we were going to have some ozone hole problems here in our own atmosphere, he suggested that perhaps pulverized gold or some other type heavy metal be used to be sprayed into the upper atmosphere to create essentially a heat shield, and that would reflect ultraviolet rays and help perhaps prevent what's come to be known as global warming, and also what could have closed up these ozone holes. And so it kind of fits in. In fact, President Obama's science czar, Holdren, just a couple of years ago, he also kind of threw up that test balloon. He said, you know, we've got a real problem here with climate change and global warming. And he said, perhaps we need to spray, he called them pollutants, but he meant heavy metals into the upper atmosphere to reflect UV rays and to protect the Earth and hold down global warming. And in fact, you know, without getting into another whole subject, there are those who say the chemtrails with the chemicals that they're spraying on us on an aerial spraying program that everybody denies and everybody acts like it's a big mystery, but all you got to do is look up and watch them do this, is that they're actually doing that right now to try to hold down this climate change and environmental change. And so apparently that was what they were after. And according to the ancient tablets, they originally were trying to get gold out of the Persian Gulf, you know, kind of like the old panning for gold in California. But that was a slow and inefficient process. So they finally decided they needed to dig for gold. I know my friend Michael Tellinger in South Africa said that they started trying to find out how many gold mines there were in South Africa because they wanted to try to keep tabs on it so that there was not a bunch of gold dumped onto the world market and upsetting the gold markets. And he said they got into the hundreds of thousands and finally just gave up counting. There were so many, and a lot of them were very, very ancient. So apparently they started mining for gold to ship back to their home planet. And then that led to problems because the records show that there were strikes and work slowdowns. And you can imagine, you know, these guys going, hey, we signed up to be astronauts. We didn't sign up to be gold miners. This is hot, sweaty, dirty work digging underground. And, of course, that led to decision to try to do something to give them a worker race that would do the heavy work for them. And that's then it really gets interesting because their science officer, Inky, and here's what's really interesting, Richard, is that they actually had a big meetings. And, of course, just like you can imagine, you had the conservatives who were saying, well, these astronauts that don't want to mine for gold, we just need to fire them, you know, or put them up in front of a firing squad, or, you know, come down on them. And then the liberals are going, no, they have a legitimate protest, and they should be able to do something about it. And Inky says, well, look, I tell you what, he said, I've been studying these Earth primitives down in my laboratory in Africa, and he said, I think I can tweak their DNA a little bit, and I think I can get us a worker race that would do the work for us, and they'll be smart enough and adept enough to take care of the work, but they won't be a competition to us. And they had the same ethical arguments we're having today about cloning and in vitro fertilization. And they're saying, hey, they said, it's not up to us to play God. We can't create anything. And he assured them that, well, we're not creating anything. We're just improving the breed. The same thing that we do with breeding cats and dogs and horses and cows and everything else, okay? So they actually went for that. They said, okay, well, yeah, we're not creating anything. We're just improving the breed. And then they even explained how they did it. In the tablets, it points out that they took the sperm of an Anunnaki male and impregnated the ovum of an Anunnaki female, and she carried it to term, and then via cesarean section delivered a hybrid that they call the Adam, or the Adama, the Earth Man, okay? And that's apparently where modern man came from, and whether you want to buy into that or not, it certainly could explain why that I know all my life I've been reading about how they've been trying to find the missing link between Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon, or modern man, and they really have never been able to find that link, and that this is why. They were tweaked, had a little DNA tweaking, and it became modern man.
And this would explain, then, our obsession with gold. It's a vestige of that genetic experiment.
Exactly.
Homo sapiens were a genetic experiment to create a race of gold miners.
Right, and our tweakers, they weren't our creators. Only God is the creator. But these tweakers, these ancient astronauts, these ancient gods with a small g, they revered gold, and they wanted gold, and they had our early man working for gold. So it's kind of come down as a racial memory that, you know, gold's important. And it is important because, hey, look at America today. We're operating under the golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules.
There you go. James has emailed me and corrected me. He says gold is an essential metal for electronics. It's better than almost any metal for electrical contacts.
Yeah, thank you, James, because I was going to mention that, too. They're already talking about gold for these fuel cells for future cars and things like that. And, yeah, I think Richard misspoke there. Gold is a very good transmitter of electromagnetic energy. It's a great conductor. But, of course, the problem is, you know, just if they want to make a fuel cell for your car and make it out of gold, think how much that's going to add to the cost. Because gold is kind of in short supply.
Indeed. But gold, of course, then gave rise to another controlling mechanism when we're talking about the world financial system, and that is these government receipts in lieu of gold. So explain then how that has developed over time and really has stayed with us.
Well, okay, let's go back, say, to the Middle Ages or even maybe about the time of Christ, and you had a big pile of gold, and so you're a wealthy guy. but you wanted to travel somewhere. Well, we'll go to the Middle Ages. We'll say you got a lot of gold and you're in England, and you wanted to make a journey to the Holy Land, visit Jerusalem. Do you want to lug all that gold with you? Number one, that would be very dangerous because there's bandits and other countries you're going to have to cross through, and you could be relieved of your gold at any point. And so this gave rise to the Knights Templars, who had, by the way, picked up a lot of knowledge from their excavations over in Jerusalem at the time that the first crusade, when they conquered Jerusalem, and they were able to excavate, and they learned a lot of this ancient knowledge that had been handed down from the Greeks and the Egyptians, and they got it from the Sumerians. The Sumerians got it from the Anunnaki, and they came back, and the Knights Templars then created what essentially was the first credit cards. So you would go to the Templar bank, say in London, and you would deposit your gold, and then they would give you a letter of credit. And then you carry the letter of credit, and then when you went to France, Italy, Turkey, wherever on the road to Jerusalem, you'd go to the temple bank there, and they would, if you needed some money, and they would give you some money, local money, based on the credit that you had deposited. And so this was like a credit card. And so basically, these letters of credit, or this paper, began to represent the real wealth that you had stored away in the Templars' banks. But then they apparently began to also realize that that's a tremendous control mechanism, because that gave rise to fractional banking, which basically is, if I give you $100 worth of gold, and then you know that I'm not going to come and ask for it all at once, so you can take a portion of that, and you turn around and loan it to Joe at interest. And then when I come and ask for my money, I get a little money back. When Joe pays back the money that you've loaned him, he pays you the interest, and you've made a lot of money off of my gold. And that's the way banking works. And so then it just got worse and worse to where today, you know, you put your money in the bank, you think they stick it in a strong box somewhere? No, they're loaning it out to people. They're making money on your money. And I know I told a banking friend of mine some years ago, he was trying to get me to place my account with his bank. And I said, okay. I said, but let me tell you something. I'm not real wild about you making money off of my money. I said, but I understand you're offering me security, and they've got the FDIC that'll guarantee it, and you got the big, strong bank building, and you can give me safety, and you give me ease of writing checks and get credit cards and ATM cards. So I said, that's okay. I said, I'll be damned. I'm going to pay you to make money off my money. And he laughed. He wrote a little note, and I don't pay any bank service charges.
All you have to
because
do is
they're charging you to make money off of your money.
Right, you called him on the game, and he backed down.
But see, most people don't understand banking, and it is. They've made it real convoluted, and they've got all this, that, and the other thing, and all of these technicalities, and most people just haven't got the time or the energy to try to wade through all that, so they just put up with it.
But this system of reserved fractional banking and fiat currency, is it your understanding that this came to man directly from the Anunnaki?
Apparently so, and because that you can trace all that all the way back through the temples and the ancient religions and on like that. And in fact, I'll tell you, you can see the connecting tissue there by simply studying mythologies. Okay, I was shocked and amazed because I'm a reasonably educated man. And I knew about the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans, and I'd studied some of their mythologies. And I always thought we're talking about separate civilizations. But you get right down to it, it's all one big, long, devolving civilization, starting with the Sumerians and then going through the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans and right on up till today. And what I'm talking about here is that the names change. Okay, but the personalities and the characterizations are exactly the same. Under the ancient Sumerians, God or their heavenly father, the guy who's in charge, but not on the earth, was called Anu. In the Egyptian, it's Amun-Ra. In the Greek, it's Kronos. And in the Roman, it's Saturn. Okay, and then the Earth Lord, the guy that was in the personality that was in charge of the Earth, and the Sumerians was Enlil, and the Egyptians was Set, and to the Greek he was Zeus, to the Romans he was Jupiter, and yet so these names change because of the language changes of these civilizations, and yet the idea, the concept, the personality is all the same, and as I said. I was really shocked to find that the word Titan actually goes all the way back to the Sumerians, which means the people that came from space, essentially.
And the same families, the same bloodlines involved in international banking.
Oh, yes. You know, anyone who studied the current banking situation should understand that at the top of the financial pyramid is the Rothschild banking dynasty. They pretty well got a chokehold on the world back going all the way back into the 1700s when Meyer Rothschild sent his sons to head the central banks in France, England, Italy, and Germany, and Austria. And so we know this, but what a lot of people don't understand is that the Rothschilds, they understand all this. They know all this. They don't laugh this off. In fact, some years ago, they actually named one of their children Nimrod. Okay, and they claim that they are the descendants of the ancient Sumerian god king Nimrod.
And Nimrod was the grandson of Noah.
Yeah.
Was he not?
Yeah. Yeah, and supposedly one of these semi-divine beings, kind of like Gilgamesh, you know, who claimed that his mother was an earth mother, but his father was one of the gods, probably one of the Anunnaki. And for so many years, I know even when I was in school, we were told Gilgamesh was just a legend and just a myth. Okay, and yet a few years back, a German archaeology team. Found what they believed to be the tomb of Gilgamesh under the Euphrates River there in Iraq.
And this this conflict, as you point out in your essay, Unholy Alliance, has really the conflict between those that control the fiat currency and the rest of us plebs, this has really defined history. I mean, from everything from civil war to political assassinations.
That's exactly right. In fact, the war between the states, our own little civil war right here in the United States, according to Otto von Bismarck, that was all caused essentially by the Rothschilds. Who stirred up, created a secret society called the Knights of the Golden Circle. John Wilkes Booth was a member, and they created all this dissension and conflict, and then they were funding both sides. They were funding the North, and they were funding the South, and they pitted the North and South against each other, stirred up all this trouble to create a war between the North and the South, with the ultimate goal of depleting both sides to where the British Army in Canada and the French Army in Mexico under Maximilian could have moved in and they could have regained control over North America, because they lost that in the American Revolution, because although they controlled the Bank of England and therefore controlled the British Empire, and then they controlled the colonies, and then the colonies revolted, and since they had the Atlantic Ocean to help protect them, they were able to have a successful revolution, and that didn't set well. And so they came back in 1812 and fought the War of 1812, but they lost that one too. So they decided they would split the Union and have North and South fight each other so they could move in and take over. Apparently the one person who understood all this was Abraham Lincoln, because if you go back and you study it, you'll find out that his whole goal was to keep the Union together.
All right, we'll pick up on that point on the other side. Jim Marrs, Our Occulted History, his latest book, and he's revisiting that topic with Unholy Alliance, Ancient Astronauts, and the New World Financial Order right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us.